I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about how Indiana's youngest citizens are faring. The Indiana Youth Institute just released its 2015 Kids Count data book a few days ago. We're going to dig into the report and find out what it says about the status of children and families here in the Hoosier State. My guest will be Bill Stanjakiewicz, the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Indiana Youth Institute. Please join the conversation. Call us toll-free at 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about the status of children and families in Indiana. The springboard for the show is the release of the Kids Count Data Book 2015 by the Indiana Youth Institute. My guest is Bill Stanjakiewicz, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. He's returning for what? This is, I think, third or fourth time. You're a No Limits veteran now, Bill.
Well, John, congratulations on the long-term success of this program. And, you know, to talk about the Kids Count in Indiana data book, the Indiana Youth Institute has a lot of partners in the media. We're glad for each and every one of them. But the data book, at one hand, can be just a list of data, but there is a lot of information behind the data, and public radio like WFYI provides us with a very special and unique opportunity to dig deeper. So thank you for this opportunity on No Limits.
Oh, we're glad to have you, and we are going to dig deeper and talk about what the data book reveals. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the show by giving us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, first, let's talk about what the data book is. And from there, we'll talk about the findings.
Well, the Indiana Youth Institute is very fortunate to be funded by the Annie E. Casey Foundation for the last 25 years, a national foundation based in Baltimore. And they provide funding to an organization in each of the 50 states, plus the District of Columbia, so that everybody can just have their hands on objective data and statistics as it relates to children and youth, whether that be for public policy, as we're right now, we're in the throes of the Indiana General Assembly, or, of course, at the federal level with Congress, even at the local level with your town council and your mayor and so forth. People also use these data, John, for their program planning in schools and youth agencies. And we also know that the youth-serving professionals who we assist throughout the state use these data for their fundraising, kind of a gold standard to include these data in your grant proposal. So what we do is we go out and we harvest the data primarily from state and federal government sources, and we put them in a very easy-to-use format. We kind of like to think of ourselves as farmers going out in the field, doing that harvest, then putting the data in a nice bushel basket along the side of the road for easy access.
And in terms of you've had the relationship with the Annie Casey Foundation for 25 years. Is that how long the data book has been in existence, or is that a more recent phenomenon?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, we were created, Indiana Youth Institute, 26 years ago by our good friends at Lilly Endowment, and the endowment has sustained us all this time, and the Annie Casey Foundation has been the primary funder of the data book for that quarter century.
So walk me through, what overall were the findings this year? Probably let me take a step back. What are the things you look at when you track? What sort of data are you looking at?
Yeah, the data are divided into different categories, such as economic well-being, health and safety, community involvement, education, substance abuse, different categories, juvenile crime. And so there are over 100 indicators provided by the state. Now, also on our website, the data book is available at iyi.org. It's linked right on our homepage right now. If you go to data and resources, or data and research on the left toolbar, you You can also pull up county data pages for any of Indiana's 92 counties. Then if you still don't find the data you're looking for, please call our team, and for free we can drill down deeper by school district, by census tract, by zip code. And so, for example, I live in Boone County, and the data are different based on whether or not you're in the Western Boone School District, the Lebanon School District, or the Zionsville School District. So we can drill down deeper as needed.
And at least the thing that's gotten the most attention so far is the information in regard to child poverty in the state. Can you walk us through some of those numbers?
You know, this is one area where the data book, we think, adds tremendous value because on balance, the economic news reported here on WFYI has been relatively positive. The economy is inching in the right direction. Right now, we have a record number of Hoosiers employed. We have the highest, largest workforce in the state's history right now. The unemployment rate has gone down. However, the child poverty rate stubbornly remains at 22%. Now, that's down just a little bit, but still much higher than where we were back in 2000 when we were near single digits with child poverty. And, you know, John, books and books have been written. College courses have been offered. People have based their entire careers on trying to understand why do we have poverty. There's no one simple explanation and no one simple solution, but many of them are related to the state's changing economy. You look at family structure. You look at access to economic opportunity. You look at, you know, some of the messages that can be internalized by our low-income children, that possibility does not exist for them, and how that impacts how they try to move forward. You know, again, sort of to get things started, the fact that the child poverty rate is at 22% is a very important number to get out there in the context of all this other relatively positive economic data.
Well, and so to drive that home, it means that somewhere between one in every four and one in every five kids in this state lives in poverty. How do we, what standard do we use when we say, you know, definitions are important here. When we say a child's living in poverty, what do we mean by that?
This is based on the federal government's definition of poverty, which goes back to, you know, all the war on poverty legislation in the late 1960s.
Yeah, so 50-year-old definition.
Yeah, exactly. And it's based on income. It's based on family size, how many children are in the household. And as our friends at the Casey Foundation just pointed out recently, and this is true with just about anything in data work, it is far from a perfect definition. We know that Indiana has some of the most affordable housing in America. San Francisco does not. The same poverty definition applies in San Francisco as it does in Logansport, Indiana, where the access to economic opportunity is different and the cost of living is very different. So it's not a perfect measurement by any means. The one thing we do have is consistency from one year to the next over the last five decades.
And these numbers, you say, have dropped slightly, but they're considerably up from, say, 15 years ago.
You really have to go back to the year 2000, John. You know, coming out of the 1990s when the nation's unemployment rate was under 4% and Indiana's was in similar territory, Indiana had one of the 10 lowest child poverty rates in the country. And then many things started to happen. One is the change in the state's manufacturing sector. We still have the highest percentage of our workforce employed in manufacturing, and I don't think any of us want to give that away. You know, it's a strength of our state, but it's a different manufacturing sector. We make a record amount of stuff every year in manufacturing. That output goes up every year, but we can do it with fewer people because of technology. It's a different manufacturing sector now, filled with computer technology and robotics, and therefore needing an education after high school, the one-year credential, the two-year associate's degree to make that car at Subaru, or, you know, to make the life sciences apparatus up in Warsaw or down at Cook. So, you know, it's we're making more stuff, but we need fewer people. The jobs that do exist actually pay quite well in the manufacturing sector, but there are just fewer of them. So that's been a big change.
Yeah, we just did a show a few days ago with the Indiana Institute for Working Families.
Yes.
You're probably familiar, and they were talking about Derek Thomas had done a report as well that indicated that the pressure really seems to be on the middle class here, that a lot of the families that are falling into poverty, it's more that they're dropping off the bottom end of middle class. Do you see similar evidence in the report that you've compiled?
I think Thomas McClarty, is that his name? Mac McClarty, former chief of staff to Bill Clinton, had a piece in the Wall Street Journal just about a week or so ago. And I thought he summed it up well when he said, we have people who can't find jobs, and we have jobs who can't find people. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're seeing happening. I happen to serve on the state's Workforce Innovation Council. It's the federally mandated oversight board for the Indiana Department of Workforce Development. And the good news is people are finding jobs. A lot of them are finding jobs at $26,000 a year, $28,000 a year. And I know that's the IIWF position, that a lot of these folks are getting these jobs that either don't lift them out of poverty or barely lift them out of poverty. And yet then at the same time, Subaru is hiring about 1,000 people right now. Those jobs pay $40,000 to $60,000 a year to start, and they can't find enough people with the level of education to fill those jobs, whether it be equipment maintenance or making the cars. The big dividing line, John, is education. Those folks I mentioned coming into the state system, the vast majority have less than a high school diploma. That is a very difficult position to be in to get a job at a sustainable wage in today's economy. The jobs that are open that pay the higher wages need some education after high school, 1, 2, 4 years. And so that's the dividing line we see. I think what our data show, and just an objective look, is we really have two economies in our state. The chasm between them is growing, and the bridge between them is your level of education.
And this probably is an appropriate time for me to inform our listeners that that if they want to hear more about this issue, they can tune in to WFYI1 at 9 p.m. this evening, when we'll be broadcasting a State of the Classroom, which you took part in, with State Superintendent of Public Instruction Glenda Ritz. And also say that this program and a lot of the others, State of the Classroom as well, and other programming we've done, is part of American Graduate, which is a Corporation for Public Broadcasting's initiative to increase the graduation rates. And this station and many other community partners are taking part in trying to get young people on the path to successful graduations. Well, in terms of these numbers, then, it seems like what we're struggling with here is repositioning the state, that what we're seeing, and as your report acknowledges, the data book acknowledges, we are seeing growth in the number of jobs, but they don't seem to be, you know, it's not an even tide. It's not lifting all of the boats here.
And again, the boats that get lifted are those that have some sort of post-secondary credentials sitting within them. The Indiana Chamber of Commerce did a survey late last year that found 39% of the state's employers have open jobs that stay open because of not enough qualified candidates. And again, qualified means education. And, you know, John, how does this play out in education? First of all, in very tangible ways. A child coming from a low-income family is much more likely to come to school hungry. Mm-hmm. I know how I am when I'm hungry and what that means to my work productivity. More likely to come to school without proper health care. That child is more likely to not have a stable home and could be moving within a school district, let alone from one school district to the next, not have a stable relationship with a teacher, all of those very tangible things. Here's the other thing that happens, though, as we talk to our friends who serve our low-income students, or if you look at some of the research that's out there, is it's very easy for these young people to internalize that success is not for them, that opportunity is not for them. It's for those folks in that other part of town or up in the suburbs or who have a different skin color than mine. And, you know, possibility doesn't exist for me, so why even try? And that's what our teachers, many of them, are dealing with. The other thing about poverty, John, is it often is very concentrated in certain school districts as opposed to, you know, we have 92 counties. It's not evenly divided across all of those 92 counties. And as Harvard University pointed out in their Equality of Opportunity Project, there is an opportunity to move up the economic ladder in America today, but it's much, much more difficult when that poverty is concentrated, and it almost always is concentrated, including here in Indiana.
We are talking about the Kids Count data book, really about the status of children and families here in Indiana. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, you know, are there specific parts of the state that have been harder hit than others? I mean, where are the places where we see more, since we've been talking about childhood poverty, children living in poverty? Where are the states that are experiencing the greatest challenges?
Certainly, we see higher rates of poverty concentrated in some of our urban areas like Indianapolis, the core of Fort Wayne, certainly Lake County, especially the northern part of the county. But what often gets overlooked is rural poverty, and that's a unique challenge in and of itself. And we need to remember, Indiana is one of the top 10 agriculture states in America, meaning we have a lot of rural areas, and the access to services becomes much more challenging. When you think about Greene County, one of the largest geographic counties in our state, which is, what, west of Bloomington, if you're living out in the countryside, it is much harder to access those services and resources. And the county with the highest child poverty rate is actually Grant County, Marion, Indiana, which is a wonderful community in so many ways, but doesn't have all the services of Fort Wayne or Indianapolis or South Bend, and is kind of there by itself, which makes it that much harder for our low-income neighbors in Grant County to access the assistance that they need.
We are talking about the status of children and families here in Indiana with the release of the Kids Count Data Book by the Indiana Youth Institute. My guest is Bill Stanjakiewicz, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the status of children and families in Indiana. A lot of information has been accumulated in the Kids Count Data Book 2015. It is a production of the Indiana Youth Institute. My guest is Bill Stanjakiewicz, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Dee, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello, Dee. What's on your mind?
My question for Bill. Hi, Bill. Glad to see you're getting your data out once more.
Thank you, Dee.
You're welcome. Children with disabilities who live in poverty have a double disadvantage and in many cases are just waiting for strike three to hit. And therefore, I'm wondering what your report has to say about children with disabilities and possible solutions. One very big problem in our state is kids who are identified with a disability that get to high school and receive absolutely no vocational rehabilitation services until the last year, sometimes the last semester before they graduate, and they're pretty much just left with nothing. Thanks for your answer, and I will take it off the air.
Thanks very much for the call, Dee.
Well, John, disability is a very broad term, and so this could mean somebody with a physical disability, could mean somebody with mental illness, it could be somebody with a learning disability. A couple of things, messages that we try to get out at the Indiana Youth Institute is for parents to be fully engaged in the development of the individual education plan that happens at the school level. And that a lot of parents don't know, you can start receiving assistance for your child from your local public school district as early as age three for your child. Under federal law, the public school districts are mandated to do this. They actually receive special funding to do this. Even if you're going to homeschool, send your child to the public charter school, or even send your child to the parochial or private school, that local public school district will still provide you assistance. So the sooner you can receive assistance for your child, the better. The parents are part of the committee that forms this so-called IEP, and you stay closely and you monitor the implementation of this. Dee also mentioned career vocational tech education. There are some employers who are very well known for hiring our neighbors who are disabled. The next time you walk into a JCPenney store, especially at the holidays, you're wonderfully greeted by some of our neighbors who are in that demographic, and there are others. But I know career and vocational education are actually a big push right now from Superintendent Ritz as well as Governor Pence, including in terms of serving our children who have disabilities.
Since we've established in this conversation so far that education is really sort of the ticket out to some degree of this, what impact has the ongoing strife, I'm not going to use war, in regard to education policy in the state had on this. Is there any way to track that?
Well, when you look at the data, you know, we have nearly 90% of the kids now graduating from high school, and that's a great development. We have over 90% of the kids passing the iRead 3 exam. That's a wonderful development. And, John, here's something that goes unreported. It's in our data book. Indiana's in the top fourth in the country in the percentage of our graduates who pursue post-secondary education. Our challenge is we need to get them to complete now. That's where we really fall short. So those are some of the positive education statistics. You know, I would say I have a very good fortune of having chances to work alongside Superintendent Ritz and Governor Pence, and they're both very well-intended, hardworking public servants. They want the best for kids. They just don't always have the same pathway to get there. They may not even agree that today is Thursday, but they're very well-intended folks. And our advice is stay in touch with your legislators, go to those town hall meetings, be contacting your House rep and your state senator. But in the meantime, John, here's what all of us can do in the midst of this strife. Ask your child what's going on in school today. Check in on their homework. What activities are they in? Visit some of those activities. Go to the ball game or the band concert with your student. Let them know that you're very interested in what's happening at school. The most important ratio in a child's academic success is not the teacher-student ratio. It's the parent-student ratio. And after that, it's the community member-student ratio, the volunteer at the youth center, the one-on-one mentor. All of us can be involved that way while our elected officials have their occasional food fight in the school policy cafeteria.
Well, and that adds actually a little more dignity to what that is than probably reality would suggest. We are talking about the status of children and families here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, we've established that there are pockets of poverty in this state. How do we stack up? I'm gonna take the comparison the other way. How does Indiana stack up with other states? I mean, do we have more problems, fewer problems, or just different problems?
We've actually improved. I've been at IYI 16 years. We used to rank in the low 30s in terms of states. Now we rank kind of in the mid-20s, so we're kind of middle of the pack. And, you know, John, we're just strong and weak in different areas. And, you know, one thing about the poverty issue, too, that we need to bring to light, it can be a complicated and difficult subject for some folks, and that's the impact of family structure on poverty. You know, we now know that nearly half of the babies born in the state of Indiana are born into a single-parent home. Now, I want to be very careful about this. Lots of caveats. Many of your listeners are single parents. Their kids are turning out great, or they're products of single-parent homes, and they've turned out wonderfully. Regardless of anybody's politics, that's President Obama and Mrs. Pence's story. They're both products of single-parent homes. We know, though, that a look at the census data show us that children in a single-parent home are 5 to 6 times more likely to live in poverty. Usually it's mom who is sticking around raising the kids, and candidly, there are some dads we don't want to have around if they're violent to mom and the kids. But this is a real issue, and we have about overall one-third of our kids after birth still staying in those single-parent situations. And again, they're not doomed. Demographics are not destiny. But in the context of poverty, these kids face greater challenges.
And how much of this is a product, you know, I think it was Senator, the late Senator Moynihan, who did some really groundbreaking research back in the, probably 20 years ago, and realized that the problem, we'd always assumed that the problem was that the number of out-of-wedlock births had exploded, when in fact it was kind of a math problem that you had to solve, that married people were having fewer children. And therefore, the other number had stayed constant since, you know, the presidency of Warren Harding. But with one number coming down proportionally, the other one seemed much greater. Are we seeing greater numbers of children being born out of wedlock, or just a greater percentage?
The numbers, I would have to look. The percentage is clear. And we just say in our culture, just the aspect of fewer people getting married or people delaying marriage till later in life. And that's a product of this, more couples cohabitating instead of getting married. And we also know some research, I believe it's from the Urban Institute, that actually a child in a cohabitating couple is much more likely to wind up in poverty or be a victim of abuse and neglect than a child even in a single-parent home, because that cohabitating couple, statistically at least, is less likely to stay together. You mentioned the Moynihan Report. Yeah, that goes back when he was Assistant Secretary of Labor back in the mid-1960s, and he was looking at just the what he called at that time, a word we were allowed to use at that time, the Negro family, not a word we use now in 2015, looking at the lack of two parents in the household. The data that he was identifying at that time within that part of American society, the numbers have actually surpassed that for all of American society in terms of children being in single-parent homes. So, again, it's not the only part of the picture. It's, as I said, poverty is very complex, lots of reasons, economic, education, but also family structure is part of that equation.
Gotten a Facebook question from Gary. He says, I am confused about the mission of the Institute. If the requirement of post-secondary education is necessary today, then is it necessary to teach how to leave their family support system? If the child cannot be supported in their current supportive environment due to low educational attainment?
Yeah, that's a great question. We want to have the starting point, assuming that all parents are involved and engaged with their kids. You know, the idea is not to say we should remove kids from their families. The organizations that we walk alongside, like Shepherd Community Center, like the Crystal Moore House, they serve kids, but then also try to get in relationship with the parents as well. But we also do hear some stories where the parents maybe will hold back their kids. You know, what do you think you're going to get ahead? What do you think you're better than me? I had a young man is down in Martinsville. I spoke at a Rotary meeting and talked about some of these economic and education and family factors. And he was from, I believe it was Jackson County, now has his own computer company. He's the only member of his family to go to college. I said, wow, congratulations. And he said, yes, my family doesn't talk to me anymore. They think I have left them. So you do hear anecdotally stories like that, John, from time to time. But again, the starting point is to involve the whole family, have the mindset that the whole family wants to be successful and the children want to be successful. And in those cases where the parents are not engaged, I will say this, the number one training request we receive at IYI is not help us raise more money. It's help us communicate with parents and get parents more engaged with their kids.
We are talking about the status of children and families and the Kids Count Data Book for 2015. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Phil, welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm calling from Indianapolis. My question is, given we have a large state budget surplus and education is the ticket out of poverty, how do you foresee us, you know, funding more primary and post-secondary education programs? All I see is less money going towards state colleges and universities.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Phil.
Well, and that's one thing about us at the Indiana Youth Institute, John, and I do not mean to upset Phil. I'm thrilled that he's listening, and he's obviously well-informed and very engaged. My first board policy from my board of directors is thou shalt not lobby. We are not allowed to take stands on public policy issues, whether it's, you know, for school vouchers or against school vouchers, you know, for more money to charter schools, less money to charter schools. And the reason is we want these data to stay as objective as possible. We want to be neutral in these discussions. So I like to say we have friends who are Republicans and friends who are Democrats, and we like to provide information to our friends. If you come visit my office sometime, you'll see a photo with then Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Bennett sitting next to and laughing with then the head of the teachers union, Nate Schnellenberger, at one of our IYI events. So I don't mean to dodge Phil's question. I would just encourage him, get a hold of these data. And however, Phil, you feel about what's happening in the State House, go talk to your elected officials. They will tell you as many as 25 phone calls, as many as 25 letters, not a form letter that's signed, but individual approaches to them can be influential in their thinking.
Well, let's take it out of the current political context, though. And, you know, at least if I'm not mistaken, the proposed state budget that just emerged from the House has about somewhere north of 60% of the state spending for the next couple of years is going to be devoted to primary, secondary, pre-K, and higher ed.
Right.
And, you know, that's not uncommon. For most states, education is the biggest part of the budget. Is the challenge that we are not spending enough money, or that we are not targeting the right areas? I mean, in education debate, do we talk enough, for example, about poverty and how we address it? Because that seems to be the area where we keep running into a roadblock.
John, I really think where the disagreements come in is how best to address poverty. I do think poverty is discussed. And on one hand, we have friends on one side of the aisle who say, therefore, our traditional public schools, where a lot of the poverty is concentrated, they need even more funding because of all the challenges. And it is absolutely true that child who comes to school hungry, the child who comes to school without health care, who does not have a stable home, let alone those messages they internalize that success is not for them, and the teacher needs to address, you know, maybe 30 kids at a time in that life. So that's one hand. Other folks say, oh, well, actually, if we want to help folks with poverty and we want parents more engaged, we need to give them a voucher and let them choose which school they want to go to. So both groups would say we're helping kids who are in poverty. They just have very different ways to go. And when you look at the three different budget proposals that are out there, you know, one on the Senate side, one on the House side, and one from the governor, even those three, controlled by the Republicans in all three categories, have different approaches in terms of how much money goes to the traditional public schools, how much goes to vouchers, how much funding, if any, goes additionally to the public charter schools.
We are talking about the status of children in families here in Indiana. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Gideon, welcome to the program.
Hi. I have a question. At some point that you mentioned there's a job that they want a person to fill it up, but they couldn't find a qualified person, and then they have been waiting years, some of them years. I was wondering, is there how actively the employee involved in training their need to the people? I know there's a few places that they will train the people to get the to fill their position. Do you have any data on that that portion?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Gideon.
Gideon raises a great point, John. We have been doing activities around the state of Indiana, thanks to funding from Lilly Endowment, in partnership with the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, the Indiana Commission for Higher Education, and CEL at UIndy. We've had one in Lafayette, one down in Batesville, one in Odin, one in Muncie, where we're bringing employers together with school counselors to help the school counselors understand today's workforce needs and tomorrow's workforce needs and the academic pathways to get there. And that's when we hear about these jobs that are open paying $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year with full health insurance or pretty darn close to it. And just about every employer at these events has said, and after we hire you, we will pay for your continuing education. We just had an event in Muncie last week. The Pioneer Seed Company, it's now DuPont Pioneer, was there. And they said, if you come work for us, we will pay 100% of your post-secondary education for the rest of your life. You want a bunch of associate's degrees, bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, we will continue to pay for them for you. And we've heard that from so many employers across the state. Where the employer struggle, again, is maybe finding people with that initial level of education to get into the door. And the other thing, John, we hear often is about the soft skills, people who show up on time, can pass the drug test, take instructions from the boss, get along with the colleagues, serve the customer right. So many employers say we need more folks who can meet those requirements, and we can teach them the specific skills of our job. Again, it doesn't explain the whole poverty situation. It's part of this complex fabric.
We have gotten a tweet from a listener named Avery, and if you'd like to reach out to us via Twitter, you can do so at WFYI. Avery says, hate to beat a dead horse here, but how do we have all of this data about poverty, yet Indiana still needs to study pre-K?
I will let you know that the legislators that I've spoken to are very well aware of the research on pre-K. They still want to have a Indiana version to gather some additional data. But the comments that I hear most, John, are, and again, this is not agreeing, I'm just relaying, you know, what we hear as we work with our friends on both sides of the aisle, that can we sustain the funding long term? Now, others would say, yeah, well, we should. Let's make it a priority. Go figure that out. But that's the comment I hear even more is when people are concerned in the State House, that's the concern, right or wrong, that they voice.
Is about long-term financial stability.
Right. You know what happens if you make this huge investment and, you know, then the next recession hits, where folks on the other side say, well, gee, dozens of other states have figured that out. Why can't we? So it'll be interesting to see how that follows through. It's very interesting to watch how corporations in the capital city here. I was just in Fort Wayne this week, learning of companies in Fort Wayne who are putting private dollars into this. And as the private sector continues to step up, to see what influence, if any, that will have on our public officials with this question.
We are talking about the status of children and families on No Limits today. We're marking the publication of the Kids Count Data Book 2015. It's a publication of the Indiana Youth Institute. My guest is Bill Stanjakiewicz, who is the president and CEO of IYI. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about how children and families are doing in Indiana. As our source is the Kids Count Data Book 2015. It's a publication of the Indiana Youth Institute. My guest is Bill Stanjakiewicz, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. Gotten a tweet, a comment from a listener named Heather, who sounds like she's a fan of yours, Bill. And if you'd like to reach out to us via Twitter, you can do so at WFYI. Heather says, finally, someone in the public education conversation that makes sense. Parent-student ratio makes a huge difference in public ed.
It sure does. You know, the research backs that up. And a concern we hear from teachers is when the parents are not supportive, it makes the teacher's job even that much harder. I had one teacher tell me that by about the third day of school, he can tell which kids have engaged parents and which don't. You know, the teachers are experts. They're in the classroom every day, year after year. They notice the difference. And when kids don't have those parents engaged, it's easy for some people in our society to say, well, we're their parents. It's the parents' job. You know what? You're absolutely right. Parents are uniquely influential and uniquely responsible. But if the parents are absent, then we have a child and we have a choice. And that's why at IYI, we have the Indiana Mentoring Partnership and Big Brothers Big Sisters and 100 Black Men and Starfish and the Indianapolis Professional Society, Shepherd Community Center, the YMCA out at Jamison Camp all have waiting lists. And all we ask is 1 hour a week to mentor a child can make a huge difference. So yes to parental engagement, and the rest of us can help as well as mentors.
And we've talked an awful lot, obviously, about poverty, and we're going to continue talking about that. But we should emphasize that there's a lot more in this report, in the data book, than simply numbers about children living in poverty. The other interesting information are the suicide numbers are alarming as well. Can you walk us through some of the other high points, and then I'm going to get us to callers as quickly as possible?
One of the high points we need to remind ourselves is that a lot of kids are doing well. Mm-hmm. You know, if 22% of kids are living in poverty, that is a challenge, but that also means 78% or not. Or, you know, you look at the data where, you know, maybe 10 or 15% of kids are in a situation, that means 85 to 90% or not. So we need to keep that in perspective and get some hope and some momentum from the positive news. But some of the challenges that jump out, John, is Indiana is number one in the country in the percentage of our kids who contemplate suicide. That's according to national surveys. 19%, one in five of our teenagers have admitted to contemplating suicide. We're also second in success of suicide. 11% of attempts are successful, and it's just so tragic. People point to a couple of different things. One would be a lack of detection of mental illness. Mm. Parents who walk through this know there are no simple solutions, and I do not want to sound naive and make it sound like this is easy if a child is bipolar or has some other type of mental illness, and families are getting the counseling and trying to get the right medication and combination of medications to help that child. But it is truly a tragic situation that families walk through when the mental illness is not detected, let alone treated. And then you also have this issue where kids aren't struggling with mental illness but feel that they're all alone, that they have nobody they can turn to. They don't have parents who are engaged. They feel isolated and then feel that they have nowhere to turn. The big takeaway here is, folks, if one in five kids admit to being suicidal, that's probably an undercount, number one. Number two, don't feel there's a stigma attached to this. You are not alone. I spoke with former Major League Baseball player Tommy John, Terre Haute native. Mm-hmm. His son took his life despite being a very successful actor and entertainer. And that was Tommy John's message. Do not feel a stigma about this. It's 2015. We can all be out in the open about these challenges so we can get our kids the help they need so they don't reach this most desperate point in life.
We are talking about the status of children and families here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Ron, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I apologize in advance. Once again, I have a rebuttal for comments that were made. I have 40 years experience in manufacturing in Indiana. 10 years ago, I got into skilled trades, which required 570 hours of additional college. And I tell you, after I got out of that, I came back in and told them that it was pretty much a waste of time. And in 25 years of working manufacturing production, I have seen where anybody with a high school education willing to apply themselves can do the job. And additional training makes me think that, you know, if they're looking for somebody with additional computer-controlled machinery experience, programming experience, then what happens to the individuals with 4 years college for programming or process engineers? All of a sudden, they're losing their jobs because of the highly educated workforce. It seems to me, after all these years, that what that has been is an excuse by corporations to send jobs out of America, saying that the uneducated workforce. In my experience, has been completely the opposite. Thank you. I'll take any comments off the air.
Well, certainly. Thanks very much for the call, Ron.
Thank you, John.
Sure. Bill.
Well, Ron has 40 years of firsthand experience and has seen that side of it. John, I just know the manufacturers I've spoken to as recently as yesterday, the folks at Subaru, they're equipment maintenance people who need 2 years of an associate's degree in kind of computer repair, understanding the technology. They have 45 openings. They maybe can fill five each year because people don't have the skills, and those are jobs that can't be sent overseas because they're looking to fix the technology there at the Lafayette plant. So it's not to discount what Ron said. Certainly jobs do get sent overseas. Generally speaking, the manufacturing jobs that have left our country are the lowest skill. The manufacturing jobs that remain in our state and in our country, generally speaking, involve the higher levels of technology. So I would just say if you can have a high school diploma and find a manufacturing job with a wage that supports yourself, great. Knock yourself out. We're just in the data business and just, you know, reporting the data and what we see and hear from employers about what's needed with levels of education.
Gotten an email from a listener named Don. If you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Don says, I'm surprised Grant County is highest on child poverty. Why not sick the social departments of the county's prestigious universities, Taylor and Indiana Wesleyan, to attack the problem?
And maybe they are. We don't know. And the role that we play, John, is for people to respond kind of in a similar way. People, so what's the solution for us here in Grant County? That's not our role. What we hope happens is people see this data. You can sometimes compare counties with each other if the counties are similar demographically and say, gee, why does our county have this high number and a similar county does not? What are they doing that we're not doing? And try to bring in best practices to change the situation. So we hope these data do inspire action, not just for elected officials and public policy, but for local community leaders to take steps, whether it be social service programs, economic development opportunities, and so forth.
And I realize you don't want to lobby, so I'm going to try to frame this question in a way. But is what you called the food fight that is our education policy-making process now in the state sort of a symbol of the way we attack? We spend so much time arguing about how to solve the problem that it sort of relieves us of the responsibility of actually trying to solve the problem.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a great question, John. I mean, it might be different on a community-by-community basis. There's no doubt there's a greater awareness now of the need for education after high school. We see that statewide as we do work in all 92 counties. You know, we see greater awareness of people knowing that they need that education beyond the typical high school diploma, and not just, you know, Commissioner Lubbers, for example, with her speech this week on the state of higher education. It certainly isn't helpful when we see our elected officials disagreeing the way that they do. And again, all we say is, in the meantime, at the local level, where the kids don't live in the state house, they live in Marion, Indiana. They live in South Bend, Indiana. They live in Indianapolis and neighborhoods in Indiana. There are things we can be doing to take steps right now while our elected officials work through their differences.
We are talking about the status of children and families here in Indiana. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. John, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I don't know what agency it was that came up with this, but I believe there was a group in D.C. that found that when individuals completed high school and had children after they were married, the incidence of poverty was less than 1%. I'm just curious what your speaker about that, particularly in regards to marriage. Indiana is becoming a controversial topic, and I just wanted to see what they had to say about that.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, John.
John brings up a finding in John Krull, one of my all-time favorite books that I recommend to everybody. And when I am asked to give speeches around the state, I reference this book. It's called Creating an Opportunity Society. Creating an Opportunity Society. It's published by the Brookings Institute, and it's written by Isabel Sawhill and Ron Haskins. Now, you know so well, John, as a follower of public policy, Isabel Sawhill was a leading domestic policy advisor to President Clinton, Democrat. At the exact same time, Ron Haskins was a top advisor to Newt Gingrich, Republican, in the House. And now they both work together at Brookings, and they came together on this book. And somewhere in the book, they say, you know what? We know there's a lot we still disagree on. But as we've worked together, we've actually found a lot of common ground in this book, Creating an Opportunity Society. Our friends on the left side of the aisle will see things they agree with. Friends on the right side of the aisle will see information they agree with, and vice versa, things they disagree with. I can't believe that's in the book. But in that book is this finding called the success sequence, looking at census data, that if you do these four things, graduate from high school and get some post-secondary education, get a full-time job, even at a low wage because of some of the social supports that are available, and get married before you have your children, you have a 2% chance of ever living in poverty. If you don't do those four things, let alone in that order, your chances skyrocket to 76%. This doesn't minimize access to economic opportunity. It doesn't minimize the impacts of globalization, but it does show a message that we can get across to our kids of what they can control. Finishing school, getting a job, how you go about family formation can largely determine whether or not you're going to live in poverty. And they lay it out in very empirical terms, Creating an Opportunity Society from the Brookings Institute. I'd highly recommend it.
How much of this, because we've obviously on this show and in the other parts of my professional life, we have a lot of conversations about persistent social problems. And in this country, poverty has probably been the most persistent one, and it spawns all sorts of other difficulties. There's clearly some correlation, it seems like, between the suicide number and the poverty number. The fact that they're roughly the same probably is not a coincidence. And it struck me that part of the reason that we cannot grapple with the problem is that even if we are talking about the same set of facts, we use different terms. People on the left will talk about poverty. People on the right often will be talking about family values or some other thing, and they're really talking about the same set of dynamics that they want to address. How much of this is that we can't grapple with these problems because it gets lost in translation?
Well, I tell you what, John, I think we have well-intended people on both sides of that discussion. And I would say at the Indiana Youth Institute, we are much closer to an all of the above as we hear about the explanations of poverty and the solutions of poverty as opposed to an either or. And another resource I would recommend to your listeners is the Equality of Opportunity Project from Harvard University. The Equality of Opportunity Project, they found six factors that can prevent you from climbing out of poverty. One of them is segregation, not just racial. social, but especially economic, where we have concentrations of people in poverty. It might be they don't have access to the jobs. How about Indianapolis? To try to ride a bus to maybe where the jobs are on the outskirts of the county can be a huge challenge. Or they don't have access to the public services. They talk about certainly K through 12 education, post-secondary education, and then they also talk about things like family formation and community engagement. It's all in there, and it's the Equality of Opportunity Project from Harvard University. I'll say this, too, and this is kind of more Bill's opinion here. I think one thing we see here is the polarization of the public policy process. And if we had a situation where we had legislative districts more drawn geographically to where people intuitively know that they live, you would see elected officials, I think, more willing and able to find common ground. What we have now on both sides of the aisle is I'm either elected from a very staunchly Democratic district or a very staunchly Republican district, and therefore not only do I not have impetus to compromise, I will be penalized if I compromise. And so I actually think
I'm not even trained to listen to other people.
And I think that, you know, you look at something that simple as just even redrawing our legislative districts at the state and federal level could help us move as a country towards more common ground, as we see in that Brookings book and from the Harvard study.
We are talking about the status of children and families here in Indiana. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for letting me join.
Certainly. I'm going to ask you to be brief because we're starting to get tight on time.
Okay. I guess I've got some heartburn when I keep hearing experts repeatedly saying youth should get a high school diploma and then go get some more secondary education. And my heartburn is I'm from Westfield, where at Westfield High School, if you're not a college-bound student, there is absolutely not a thing at that school for you. So I think we're hiding from the gorilla in the room, which is I think high school is misdirected and the resources are poorly allocated, and that needs to be looked at versus, okay, I'm going to spend 4 years in high school, waste my time, not learn what I need for work, and then I have to go get secondary education to be of value to companies in the Indiana area. And if you have time, I'll listen to whatever you have to respond to that off the air.
Thanks very much for the call. Thanks very much for the call, Kevin. Thanks.
John, here's a big area where the gap exists. First of all, we need more students aware of dual credit. Parents, students, ask your school counselor about dual credit. These are post-secondary credits you can earn while you're in high school. Our good friend Tom Snyder at Ivy Tech will even note you can earn your Ivy Tech degree while you're in high school at no cost and have your high school diploma and your associate's degree, 18 years old, ready to be employed. The other thing is, back in the day, we all had the auto shop in our high school building. We had the wood shop, the electric shop in our building. What the state has done is move the career tech ed to 49 locations across the state that are shared by multiple public school districts. Out of sight, out of mind. If I'm not in that high school where the CTE center is located, it's very easy for me not to be aware of that. State leaders are trying to change that now to maybe introduce some career tech ed into every high school to make kids aware of those pathways and then the deeper level learning that can happen at the CTE sites.
I'm going to try to get this in. Listener named Deanne reached out to us via Facebook and said, really, the broadcasting that a child is disadvantaged because he or she is the product of a single-parent household is like broadcasting that a child is disadvantaged if he or she is a black child, basically that it is discriminatory. I want to give you a real quick chance to respond to that. I wanted to get her point on the air, though.
Two things. It's not what I said. And second of all, it's just census data. Marion Wright Edelman of the Children's Defense Fund, you're much more likely to live in poverty in a single-parent home. You're not doomed. President Obama grew up in a single-parent home, as did Mrs. Pence. We're just saying statistically, there's a greater challenge economically with just one parent in the household.
Well, I think that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guest, Bill Stanjakovich from the Indiana Youth Institute. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for sending, as usual, some really great questions. Hope you all have a great weekend. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.